In this episode of the Airplane Geeks podcast, we talk with the founder and CEO of Vans Aircraft about kit planes. In the news, Boeing doesn't plan to change the Dreamliner for Emirates. NASA is looking for astronauts. The first customer-built subsonic jet flies. The Pilatus PC-12 bizjet also takes its first flight. And livestock pass gas. Welcome to the Airplane Geeks Podcast. This is episode 376 of the show where we talk aviation. I'm Max Flight, and I'll introduce the co-hosts. First, we have Brian Coleman. Hi, Brian.
Hi, Max. It's great to be here, and my 2 weeks off of not flying are over. So I spent last week in St. Louis. I'm currently in Tampa, and next week I'm off to San Francisco.
Wow. So racking up those miles.
I am.
Very, very good. Very good. Also with us is Max Trescott. He's a CFI and author, a glass cockpit expert. Max West, how are you?
Hello there, everybody. Max here. I'm really happy to be here. By the way, I spent the weekend listening to a whole bunch of our past podcasts, and holy cow, we've had some fun guests lately, and I think we've got another great one tonight.
Absolutely, absolutely. Let's also mention that Rob Mark should be joining us. He was with us, but he keeps falling off of Skype, so we'll try to bring Rob Mark back in. Hopefully he'll join us. Also, our aviation historian, David Vanderhoof, will not be able to join us. He had intended to be here, but he's not able to, and he sends his apologies to all of you. Well, our guest this episode is Dick Van Grunsven. He's the founder and CEO of Vans Aircraft, really the acknowledged leader in the kit aircraft world. Now, Dick has been flying since 1956. He's logged more than 15,000 hours, most of which, I guess, have been in airplanes of his own design. He holds a CFI, multi-engine, and ATP ratings. Dick, welcome to the Airplane Geeks podcast.
Yeah, I'm glad to be here, I think. So, well, let's get on with it.
All right. Now, Dick, we mentioned this before we started recording, that you were the most recent recipient of the Godfrey L. Cabot Award, and that's presented by the Aero Club of New England. Tell us about that award. The past recipients, it reads like a who's who of aviation.
Yes, it does. It's a little confusing in a way because being here on the West Coast and for whatever reason wasn't really familiar with the Aero Club of New England and didn't really know what to think of that invitation or honor until I saw the list of recipients and started off with Igor Sikorsky, and I thought, well, if I can be on that list... Even though I may not know much about the club, that sounds, and it was wonderful. They flew myself and my wife back there and entertained us royally for a couple days, and it was a great experience.
And I actually visited that club for one of their events last year. They are the oldest, longest continuing aviation club in America. And they were founded like before the Wright brothers flight. I mean, they go back to 1902, 1903. It's really quite remarkable.
It is. It really is. And this Cabot Award is given, they say, for individuals or teams who have made unique, significant, and unparalleled contributions to advance and foster aviation or space flight. So, Van, that's quite an honor. As you mentioned, you joined the likes of Igor Sikorsky and Vern Rayburn, the Clapmeyers, Phil Boyer. God, I mean, the list goes up. Crandall and Kelleher on that list, Fawcett, the Rutans, Bert and Dick. I mean, just everybody. It's a great honor to have you with us, and we're really excited to be talking about kit planes and experimentals and home builds and all that coming up. Before we do, first of all, I see that Rob Mark, I think you've come back to join us on Skype.
I'm back.
All right. Very good. So,
yeah, sorry. I don't know what happened there. The internet coughed.
It coughed and and spat you out.
And you caught a cold.
Yeah. But you're back. All right, good. One more introduction. We have joining us Mark Newton. You might have heard us recite some of Mark's letters to us. Mark is one of our engaged listeners, and we're really pleased to have him join us. Mark, you're also an RV6 owner.
I am, yes. I have a RV6 that was, I think its first flight was 1994 in Albany, in Western Australia. And I've owned it since 2011 and put about another 400 or 500 hours on it. And it's an amazing machine. It's really top-notch work from Van to design it.
Very cool. All right, well, we're going to be talking about these RV planes coming up. First, though, we've got some news to talk about. So I'll ask, is everyone ready?
Ready. Matt.
Ready from the West.
Ready from Sydney.
Our first item comes from Reuters. This is Boeing says will not make changes to Dreamliner stretch for Emirates. Now, Emirates has said that they will decide next year, in 2016, if they're going to order, well, almost 100 aircraft. They're considering the Boeing 787-10 or the Airbus A350-900. Emirates needs, well, they need long-range planes that can operate in hot climates. So they've got a choice to make. We see this with Emirates and with others, especially in the Middle East, where the airlines are looking for increased efficiencies. And, you know, they try to communicate that to the airframers. I guess in this case, Boeing is saying that, well, you know what, we're not going to stretch the Dreamliner, at least not right now.
Yeah, I thought that was a really interesting story because not only is Boeing saying we're not stretching it for you and making it available for you to take off from those really hot runways in Dubai, at the Dubai Air Show, Airbus also said we're not going to re-engine the A380 for you either. They're really not getting their way this week.
Yeah, obviously airlines have lots of communications with the airframers, right? The Boeings and Airbuses and Bombardiers and the others don't just sit around in a conference room and decide on their own what's best or what they think is best for the airlines. There's always a lot of communication, a lot of meetings between them with the engine OEMs and with other suppliers. You don't usually see this kind of thing playing out in the press or in the public. Usually it's behind closed doors, but with the A380, as you mentioned, Brian, and here with the Boeing Dreamliner, Emirates kind of does use the press.
Yeah, but I think what's going to happen is Airbus is going to get the order for the A350, and Boeing's going to lose out on the 777 orders. That's just my opinion.
And why do you think that? What's your rationale on that?
Oh, just because I think Airbus has the engineers and are willing to put the investment behind the A350, and because they're going to lose out on the A380, they'll put the effort and engineering resources behind it, and Boeing's just saying no. And, you know, Boeing has enough orders for the 777 where, you know, they have backlogs for several years. So I just don't think it matters as much to them. And Airbus needs to make the A350 a success.
Does Boeing even think it needs to modify the Dreamliner to suit these requirements? I mean, they've barely started shipping the 787-9s yet. So it may turn out that there's enough fat in the design to meet these requirements without changing it.
Well, it might be tougher for them to redesign it as well, just simply because they outsource so much of that particular airliner. It's got to be a lot more complex to make changes than it would be for something that they designed largely in-house, which is how they did most of their previous airframes.
Another aspect of this is the availability of engineering resources, and this is something that you don't often see described in the press, but you know, each of these companies has a huge engineering workforce, but it's not of infinite size and capacity. You can only work so many programs before you run out of engineering resources. And Airbus certainly has a lot on its plate with the A320neos, with the A350, with the A330.
I was
going to
say, even with the 330. Yep, absolutely.
Yeah, yeah. So, I mean, that can be a factor in Airbus's decision as to whether or not they're going to listen to what Emirates would like to see done to the A380. But, you know, it's big stakes games. I mean, you don't want to irritate your customers, but you don't want to make bad decisions that are going to cause you more problems down the road. So I know, Van, when you're looking at aircraft, I mean, we're talking about, you know, an existing aircraft, and do you modify it or do you wait till the next cycle and design a new aircraft, kind of clean sheet of paper? How have you approached that over the years with the different aircraft that you've designed? Are they derivatives or is each one unique?
Well, we're in a lot different field than they are, and typically we make only minor modifications to airplanes. Normally we'll just move on and maybe build upon what we have and make it into a new design. Boeing and Airbus, of course, they go into this with the idea of stretching and expanding and growing a design. We just haven't taken that approach, and it's not like we're going to take a two-place and try and make a four-place out of it by, you know, making longer wings, et cetera, et cetera. We're better off to start over, but it's a different model entirely.
Sure.
than the type of aircraft that Boeing and Airbus are talking about. So in the case of resisting or not refusing, but I don't know what the right word for it is, following through on the request, it may well be the reasons that you guys are already referred to, just lack of resources to do it right, or it might be that the request of the airline is really pushing the limits. While it might be doable, it might be beyond what they're comfortable with, at least with the timeline that it would be required. So that would be kind of my guess from strictly the other end of the industry.
Sure, sure. Well, it'll be interesting to see, you know, how this plays out. It's almost, commercial aviation is kind of theater in general, I think, sometimes. And it's kind of fun to watch. Let's move on to the next item, which is kind of interesting. Turns out that, well, let's talk space a little bit, in particular NASA. NASA has announced that they're going to begin recruiting a new astronaut class by the summer of 2017, 8 to 14 people. And this is actually an item that our listener Young Lim Fu from Singapore might want to pay attention to, because we've had some feedback from him over the years about entering into the space program. But they're actually looking for some astronauts. These are people who will be, well, they might go to the space station, they might go to the moon, or they may end up actually someday going to Mars. Pretty exciting stuff.
And only 6,100 applicants? Yeah, yeah. I guess HR has a few pieces of paperwork to sort through.
Well, I think that was from the last group, and I'm not sure on that, but you're right. The door opens and not very long, and when it does, a lot of people go rushing through it. So anybody wants to become an astronaut, this is your chance. I'm lucky enough to get to read scholarship applications that come into the Aero Club of Northern California, and last year we had a gentleman who said he wanted to become a civilian astronaut, and I remember at the time kind of being surprised, because he's a pilot in normal aviation college. But then I realized, you know, if you're in your 20s, there's no reason why you couldn't be a civilian astronaut for, Virgin Galactic or even for NASA.
Does NASA still require astronauts to be U.S. citizens? I know that Australia had an astronaut by the name of Andy Thomas who flew on the space shuttle a couple of times, but he had to take out dual citizenship before he could fly.
Wow.
Is that still a requirement?
Well, you know, I'm not sure, but I do know that NASA has a website where they have information for people who are maybe considering this, and they make it actually very easy. It's nasa.gov/astronauts. So if you're thinking about maybe throwing your hat into the ring, as it were, you can take a look at that site, nasa.gov/astronauts, and check that out. Interesting stuff.
I wonder what they get paid.
Boy, I have no idea. It might not even matter, you know?
I think most of them, as I recall, are in the military service, and they get paid whatever their military pay is. I think they're actually on loan to NASA. I'm not sure they're NASA employees per se, though I'm sure some of the mission specialists are, because they probably didn't come up through the military.
What currency do they even use on Mars?
Yeah, that's right.
Well, if you saw the movie recently, I mean, apparently being a botanist is an advantage.
And pay them in potatoes.
Yeah. In fact, we should say that it might be a spoiler. If you haven't seen the movie Martian,
yeah, I haven't seen that.
Go, you definitely gotta see that. Yes. It is so good.
I've heard it's
great. Was a good one, Rob.
Absolutely, absolutely. Yeah. Matt Damon does a really, really outstanding job, I think.
So on the salary issue, Rob, what sort of salary would be required to entice you to take a trip into space?
More than I'm making now.
Really? I'd do it for free.
Yeah, I was going to say, that's a freebie.
Yeah.
Well, but you know, it's interesting. They were talking about, I don't know if I heard that in the movie or what, about the fact that everybody that raises their hand says, oh, man, I'd go in a heartbeat, until they realize that. And Mark, if you saw that movie, what did they say the travel time was to Mars from Earth? It was like 3 years or something.
It's between months and years, depending on where in the orbits Earth and Mars are. It's a very long time.
Yeah, and they say that, you know, people don't factor in the being confined, being away from their families, being next to people that they think they like, that later on they realize they don't particularly care for, and that's just getting to Mars, and then they have to come back. So that maybe more people might not raise their hands if they thought it through, but I don't know.
There's also the risk factor. I know NASA projected on the shuttle that there was about a 1% mean time to between failure, and it turned out to actually be very accurate when you look at the two shuttle losses and approximately 200 launches. And I don't know, for a 1% chance of not coming back, I think I'd pass on the space ride.
I have visions of a group of NASA statisticians looking at those accident stats and going, yes, success.
Yeah.
I don't know. There's a difference to me between going into orbit, something like the space station, going to the moon, which seems tolerable, versus going to Mars. So ask the question carefully. I'd go into orbit. I'd go to the moon. I'm not sure if I'd sign up for Mars.
Yeah, sort of increasing levels of commitment and risk there. All right, let's push on to our next item. This comes from the EAA, first customer-built subsonics personal jet flies. So Reg Greenberg, he's from Durango, Colorado, he received the first subsonics kit, serial number JSX-0003, in February, and it's built. Now he's the first customer to build and fly the subsonics personal jet. It was a 35-minute flight. We've talked about the sonics planes before, and the jet is something new. Rob, have you seen the sonics planes?
Oh, yes. They're cute little buggers. They really are. I mean, they almost look like toys, but, they are the product of the Manette family up there at Oshkosh.
Right.
And it was John's dream for the longest time. When I asked him why, he said, I don't know. I always wanted my own jet. So he kind of designed his own. And turned it into this kit. And I think for years people thought it was just going to be it sounds tacky to say a flight of fancy, or fantasy. But he actually made it all come together. And, of course, I think when I first saw that story, I thought of his son, Jeremy, who passed away earlier this year just before Air Venture, because Jeremy was very involved in the subsonics project, and I'm sure he would have been really thrilled to see it go out to the first customer.
Van, I'm sure you probably know the Manette family. What any thoughts on the jet? And is a jet something you'd ever consider for a Vans aircraft?
Oh, probably not. Not in the near future anyway. And I admire, I respect what they're doing. There's different ways of evaluating an airplane like that. And at this point, it's mostly a novelty, and that is not to be critical of either doing it or anyone buying it. But we tend to look at things rather analytically, and it's not a market we're looking at getting in the near future.
Well, my recollection is that it's got a, and I haven't looked this up, so I don't remember for sure, but it's got a really short endurance time. Does anybody remember how many minutes you could stay in the air with this plane?
It's more than that. It depends upon if you're flying, if you're running the engine hard. It seemed like they have something around 40 gallons of fuel, if I'm right. And at high power, it's running over 30 gallons an hour. So it will stay in the air for an hour or more, I think, at high power settings, and considerably longer if you're at an economy cruise. It's a relative term, of course.
Hmm.
Well, for somebody that wants a jet, it's got a few extra bucks, I think it would be exciting for the same reason that John Monette himself wanted it. Just kind of a bucket list thing. And I wouldn't say a bad choice, but I'd better not say any more.
It's a different choice, that's all. And we see from the article that there are six more customer kits that are currently being built, so we can anticipate seeing some more of those in the skies.
Well, and I think that kind of tells the story right there, right? Six of them. It's not a huge market. I mean, it's a pretty small niche, I think, folks that want to, you know, build a one-place jet.
One of the things that I enjoy about this story is looking at how quickly the state of the art has been advancing. 10 years ago, you couldn't buy microturbines. About 5 years ago, you could, and a mate of mine retrofitted three of them onto an ASW-20 single-seat glider to produce a self-launcher, but he had to scratch-build that, built all of his parts, designed his own fuel system, did everything himself in his garage. Now you can buy a quick-build kit that has it all basically done for you. It's an assembly issue after that, and for such a short amount of time for it to have advanced so far, I think is just awe-inspiring.
Yeah, that's true. And Mark, your flying career, as it were, your interest in flying really started with gliders, didn't it?
Yeah, it did. Yeah, about 1999, I started gliding. I had to divert to a gliding field because I was a passenger on an aircraft that had to deck it because of bad weather. And I visited the gliding field the following weekend by car and started flying and haven't looked back since.
Sometimes it's just a matter of where you are, you know, what place you're in at what time. That's
exactly. Yeah. If it wasn't for that strong wind preventing us from getting to where we were before we ran out of fuel, I probably wouldn't have got into aviation.
Yeah. just out of curiosity, what field was that the gliders were at?
It's a place north of Adelaide in South Australia called Lochiel. It was about a mile from a 800-foot high ridge, which was fantastic for training. It was a really good environment to learn how to fly gliders in.
Yeah, I was just curious because I've done soaring in Australia before, but never at that field. So,
Van, I was just wondering, with the design of this, it's using a V-tail. Is there any efficiencies behind that with this jet?
Well, I think the main reason they're using the V-tail there is to keep it out of the way of the thrust path of the engine.
Because it's a top-mounted engine, yeah.
They also use a V-tail on a couple of their other models, but in theory, there's an efficiency advantage. That's the reason Beechcraft used it on the Bonanza initially. In practice, I don't think it makes a very noticeable difference. And personally, I think it's aesthetically pleasing. And, you know, I owned a Bonanza at one time, and I had a V-tail sailplane at one time. And from the cockpit, you obviously don't know much difference. Structurally, you'd say, well, yeah, you got one less tail surface, but usually a more complex control system to integrate the rudder and elevator movements into the same surface. So there's a more complex linkage. Answer the basic question, though, it's kind of a six of one, half dozen of the other, probably.
And there's another V-tail just about to come out, and that's the Cirrus SF-50, which is also a single-engine jet.
And probably for the same reason. There's one sailplane, Bob Carlin has down in Albuquerque area, that they use for training, and Monettes have worked with him on training for jet ratings and such, type ratings for the subsonics. That airplane has, that sailplane has the same engine. It has a normal vertical tail, T-tail, but they've got a thrust deflector on that. In other words, they've got a kind of a split tailpipe to deflect the thrust so it does not hit the tail surface that's directly behind it. So I think that's enough indication of why both Cirrus and the subsonics have the V-tail. It just, it keeps the surfaces out of the way of that hot air.
Makes sense. All right, let's talk about biz jets a little bit, in particular Pilatus Aircraft. And they've had their first flight, well, that was back in May, their first flight of the PC-24, six-passenger business jet. Deliveries expected to begin in 2017 in the U.S. in the second half of the year. And this article we see in the Wichita Eagle talks about how this will be a competitor for the Cessna Citation business jets. Rob, do you see it as a direct competitor?
Oh, I think it probably will be to some of the airplanes. The one thing that stands out in my mind is that the PC-24 will, you can put it down on a grass runway. And now, I grant you, there are probably not hundreds of thousands of pilots looking to put the thing down on a grass runway. But what I think it does is it sort of extends that Pilatus that Pilatus brand by having an airplane that is built very ruggedly and is you know, ready to take just about anything. It's almost as fast as the Citation XLS. It carries about the same, doesn't go quite as far. I think maybe 100 or 200 miles less, but it's quite a bit less money than the XLS. So it's right in the kitty there somewhere, I think. And again, hopefully it's going to be a really rugged airplane like the PC-12 is, and that thing is, that's like flying a Chevy Suburban. And you know, and that's the other issue too, is I think the PC-24's cabin is going to be a good deal. I think 20% larger than the Citations.
Interesting.
Big enough for a doctor, two nurses, and a couple of stretchers, because the Royal Flying Doctor Service is one of their initial customers, and that's one of the reasons why it's able to fly into unimproved airstrips. The flying doctors have been operating PC-12s successfully for years, flying into cattle stations in the middle of nowhere.
And haven't you guys gotten runways down there?
Oh yeah,
but not gotten any runways yet.
Just every now and then there's one.
Oh, okay. No, but that's a good point, though, and I think they're hoping there will be follow-on customers that either did or do own PC-12s that may say we can extend our reach with the 24 and get an awful lot of the same kind of handling characteristics. But we'll see.
And I just remembered something too. The former marketing manager of Cessna is now the marketing manager of, guess what, Pilatus. So he knows a lot about the business. And you look at the just the success of the PC-12. I think they've just got an amazing reputation. This is a very logical step for them. And since Cessna really dominates the mid-range segment for business jets, I think they're going to feel the heat from Pilatus. I think Pilatus will probably give them quite a run for their money.
Hey Rob, I've asked this question before about the 787-8 and 9 over a few hundred nautical miles actually making a difference. For something like this, does 200 extra miles really make a difference?
Depends on how low you are on fuel.
So, yeah, sure, but
well, normally you wouldn't be stretching any airplane to the limits very often. Maybe once in a great while if the destination weather was clear and the wind was with you, maybe. But What I often find is that in terms of the range, it usually means that the airplane's carrying a little more fuel than it did before. And sometimes operators will say, well, you know what? The range is nice, but I can take a little bit of that fuel out and carry another person or two. And that adds to their flexibility. So that it's not all just about the actual number of miles it'll go.
All right. One last item before we talk to Van. This is, well, you know, you just go out on the web anywhere and look at anything, and there's clickbait everywhere, you know, just things that catch your eye and you just seem to be unable to resist clicking them. This was one
Max,
of them.
Max, this is a family show. I don't know where you're going with this.
Well, this is from the Huffington Post. The headline is "No Evidence Farting Livestock Caused Emergency Landing." Well, how could you not click that, right?
Exactly. We all want
Is there
to know.
Any evidence that it didn't?
Well, the Aviation Herald reported that a Singapore Airlines plane with 2,186 sheep aboard diverted to Bali after, quote, exhaust gases and manure produced by the sheep caused the smoke detector to go off.
Nah, that you really got, didn't happen.
You got to love this story on every level.
Singapore Airlines says that there's no evidence that that these sheep, or sometimes it's reported as that them being goats, so that's kind of confusing too. But there's no evidence that these sheep emissions actually caused
sheep
the,
emissions.
Farts. I mean, what do you? I don't know. Is that a bad word? I don't.
I think you missed flatulence.
You missed Brian's little joke in there before, I think, when he went, nah, that's not it.
So. The thing that amazed me.
No, they were just ignoring me.
I guess. Yeah, the thing that amazed me most about this is they put 2,100 sheep on an airplane?
The thing that amazes me the most is that Singapore Airlines would let them put them on their airplane. I mean, they have such an amazing reputation for service. What were they thinking about putting sheep on the airplane?
Yeah, this story is wrong in so many ways.
I know.
How many flight attendants do you need for 2,100 passengers?
Yeah, yeah. And what's the sheep pitch for that many passengers?
Oh. Oh.
Bada-boom. Where's Dan when we need him?
So can we safely say that this is the kind of segment that we should occasionally include on our shows? This is just too good not to pass up.
How can you not? How can you not?
Yep.
Yeah, I think this whole segment was a gas myself.
Oh, boy. Here we go.
All right, again, we're speaking with Dick Van Grunsven. He's the founder and CEO of Vans Aircraft, probably the largest. Van, are you the largest manufacturer of kit aircraft?
Oh, to the best we know, yeah.
Because I think that there's more RVs flying than any other experimental aircraft. Can you tell us a little bit about sort of the size of the market? I mean, how many experimental pilots, how many kit aircraft, how many home builds do you see out there across the spectrum?
Well, it depends upon the perspective, I guess. There had been somewhere around 30,000 amateur builds registered in the U.S., but now that we're going through the re-registration cycles, this three-year re-registration cycle, I think some are dropping off because they had just been abandoned or whatever. So I would say now we're probably in the 23,000-25,000 active in the U.S., just from some of the statistics I had seen. As far as the market for new kits, I think it's been shrinking in recent years, kind of just along with aviation in general. Hmm. So I don't know if anybody really has a count of or is able to chart that. From our own business, I think there's been a bit of shrinkage in the last few years. Still healthy enough, but it's certainly it's not an exciting growth industry. So pardon the downer, but that's the honest answer.
Yeah, and I imagine it must track pretty well with the number of pilots, right? We see the number of pilots decreasing, so you would kind of expect that to be the case in the number of those pilots who are interested in home builds.
Right. Yeah, there's probably a whole lot of factors involved. That's one of them. The other is maybe a bit of market saturation. Amateur-built aircraft usually kind of fit in a certain category of performance or, well, yeah, just what they do and who wants them.
Yeah.
And with the number that have been built, whether they're Venn's products or others, there's a certain saturation there, and we see probably an increasing number of airplanes changing hands, being sold, re-merchandised or whatever you want to call it. It's also the circumstances have changed in 20 years ago if you built an airplane, at least a popular one, which might have been a Glass Air or Lance Air or Vans or whatever. You'd fly it for a while and sell it for considerably more than what you had invested, and that's not true anymore. So for someone wanting the airplane now, first, there are more of them out there in on the used market. And second, you can buy it for the same or less than you could actually build one yourself. So obviously that is going to have an impact on the new kit market.
And Van, doesn't it take about 2 years to build one of these?
Generally, the average is even more than that, just because of the limited time that people have to apply to it and their work habits and so on. We, like most everyone else, publishes kind of estimates of the construction time, but a lot of people exceed those estimates. Not that they're invalid estimates, but people just kind of work to different standards than we use for making the estimates.
Sure, and that makes sense. I mean, everybody has a different amount of, I'll call it free time or time that they can devote to building their airplane. And so there's probably a lot of variety. Is there a certain type of person that you could characterize as someone who's a good candidate for building a plane?
Not really. If you're talking about their backgrounds as far as their occupation or profession, it's pretty hard to categorize that way. There may be other parameters if you got into looking at people from the type A, type B, or the psychologist perspective, but I don't have a good answer for it.
I think a successful builder would be somebody who enjoys a challenge and is capable of focusing on something for a very long period of time. So it does demand a lot of personal resources for a great many years to start with a pile of sheet metal and rivets and turn it into an airplane.
Yeah, Mark, it's kind of a commitment.
Yeah, a former boss of mine built one, and he was an engineer at Hughes. So, and all of his friends that were building aircraft, they were all engineers as well. And that just might have been a part of being in Los Angeles with the aerospace industry that we have here. Yeah. But
I think you're probably right there that the people with technical backgrounds like that would be more likely to build. But it's not an absolute either, because there are some people in those fields that are the worst builders. So it's a little hard to come up with absolutes. Anyway, it doesn't matter, just as long as there's enough of them. I don't care what their background is.
Sure, sure. Van, how did you come to start the company? Was this something that you sort of had a vision and planned for, or something that unfolded? How did it come about?
Well, it's just something that, in general, I would have liked to have done or had envisioned possibly doing, even long before I was old enough to. But as far as a business, as far as making a living at it, prior to the time that I entered the field, there was not really an industry. So there weren't really models out there to follow. So it was really a matter of, in a way, being at the right place at the right time with the right motivation. And then after that, other kit companies sprang up, and then it became something that, you know, you had kind of a model for that you could perhaps aspire to, rather than just dream about a vague possibility.
Well, I don't think anybody can really debate the success of the company, but is there something that you can point to that is kind of responsible for your success?
Well, first, I didn't answer the question too well, that I kind of got started just building more for myself and with the idea that, you know, as people were offering plans and very rudimentary kits at the time, and I didn't have a real stable occupation at the time, so that if there was a demand, I would try to get into that. And it just worked out. Then as far as the airplane, starting out with the RV3, which is only a single place airplane, but at the time a lot of the home builds were single seat. But the one thing that even from the very beginning, that airplane and most of my subsequent designs have had a broad base performance. In other words, could do a number of things quite well, not the most excellent in any one parameter, such as speed or climb or aerobatics, but kind of a jack of all trades, if it's a good analogy.
Mm-hmm.
And that's probably as much as, well, the basic reason for the popularity, as well as being reasonably easy to build and attractive and good handling qualities, and hopefully the things that pilots are looking for.
Sure. Let's talk about safety for just a minute, because our audience is kind of mixed in terms of background. I mean, we have a lot of pilots who understand the amateur-built aircraft concept, and some others that have interest in other areas of aviation that may not be as familiar with it. So, you know, for that part of the audience, can you address how we ensure that these people who are building these airplanes are going to end up with something that's going to be safe for them to fly?
Well, it depends upon what they start off with. Assuming that it's a well-designed kit and a proven design, then it's really just up to the quality of workmanship of the person constructing it as to whether what he does is then representative of the proven prototype or design. And you can have all variations of that. There have been plans and kits offered that were not up to the same standard or the median of the industry. As far as the individual builder, though, again, that's just the quality of work that he puts into it. Mm-hmm. And that he doesn't cut corners or do things that are going to detract from the inherent structural integrity or handling qualities or safe flight properties of the airplane. Otherwise, though, there are no particular standards that the people offering products have to really adhere to, and it's more of just a market-driven standard that has been applied over the years.
Okay, so that was going to be my next question, as to whether the designs have to be approved from a regulatory standpoint or anything like that. And so it sounds like it's it kind of a function of the reputation, the track record, the quality process of the kit manufacturer.
That's exactly true.
Hey, Max, that ties in with a question that I had. In being the non-pilot of the group, I get to ask all the dumb questions. When you go to buy a plane, do you have to be a certified pilot, or can you buy a plane and or a kit and not be a pilot?
Basically, you don't have to be a pilot to buy something. You have to be a pilot to legally operate it.
Right. Same as an automobile, right, Brian? So you don't have to have a driver's license to buy a car, but you do have to have a driver's license to operate it. So similar, right?
So I know one builder of an RV-12 who doesn't have a pilot's license, and his intention is to finish building the RV-12 and then use that aircraft as the aircraft that he gains his license in. Hmm. So he'll go and contract an instructor and go through the syllabus and do his pilot's license in an aircraft that he built.
Mark, what attracted you to the RV-12 that you bought?
The RV-6.
The RV-6.
I was initially with a group of a couple of other people, and we put together a short list of attributes that we wanted the aircraft to meet. Probably comes back to what Van was saying about the performance envelope of the aircraft. The RV6 that was for sale at the time that we were looking just ticked pretty much all of the boxes that we had on our list. There were other aircraft that were also for sale that only ticked some of them, and better in some respects and worse in others. But the RV6 was a good compromise, and it just turned the whole decision of what to buy into a complete no-brainer. So I initially bought it with two other people, which was a good way of keeping the costs down. And I then bought it from those when I moved to Sydney a few years ago.
Oh, and did you learn to fly on the RV6?
No, I initially learned to fly in gliders and then got a private pilot's license in Cessnas in 2008. So I learned in 152s and 172s.
And how do you like?
And then got a tailwheel rating in a Super Decathlon, and that was fairly good preparation for the RV. I mean, I was accustomed to aircraft that were very sensitive on the controls already from single seat sailplanes. Hmm. So once I'd sort of done the study and the experience to gain a tailwheel rating in a decathlon, it was a relatively straightforward transition into the RV after that.
I would have to agree that your background was good, because one thing that glider pilots learn is how to use their feet. If you don't, if you aren't able to use the rudders regularly, you're not going to make it in the sailplanes. Plus, typically the pitch forces, the elevator forces, are very light on the modern sailplanes. So you were well prepared. If you just stepped out of a Cessna 172 or something, well, then as you well know from having flown both, the RV6 is considerably different. Whether it's better or worse is a matter of opinion, but requires a little finer touch on the controls than a 172 would.
I do enjoy watching the face of a 172 or 182 pilot the first time they take the controls of my RV6. It's something fascinating to watch their facial expression evolve as they work out how sensitive the controls are and just how much fun it is.
Yeah, well, different strokes are, different strokes for different folks. But most people, and I don't know if you would make the statement, they don't want to go back. They don't want to go back to where they started. So that's one reason our airplanes are popular. And perhaps the one attribute, more than the qualities I mentioned before, the speed or the climb or the range or anything else, is the immeasurable quality of the control harmony and the handling properties of the airplane that I would have to say is probably the one singular thing that really keeps the people flying those airplanes.
Hey, Van, how do you maintain that throughout your entire product line?
Well, just by not straying too far from the well. In other words, kind of, and if you look throughout our designs, they're just kind of relatively incremental changes from one model to another. And over time, we've just kind of learned how to design the control systems and control surfaces on the airplane to retain these sort of qualities. I think in some cases, designers just don't put that much emphasis on it. They're looking more just for pure speed or short field performance or whatever it is, and just figure, well, regardless of what the handling qualities are, it's going to be good enough because, the buyer isn't necessarily looking for that. He's looking for the other properties I just mentioned. I think we are seeing more now. I think, for instance, of the recent improvements they've made on the Carbon Cub. And the Cub never was any great shakes on handling qualities. You had to push and shove and kick to make it fly. But they have made improvements, particularly on aileron control. So it's encouraging to see people paying attention to that and adding that quality to the other package of qualities they already have.
Something I was curious about, Van, I mean, with all the thousands of kits that are out there, I'm sure there must have been times where people just you know, I don't know, lost steam maybe two-thirds of the way through or halfway through. Or, I mean, do you ever get calls like that where people just say, I don't know if I can finish this, and maybe I'm not – what do you tell people like that?
Well, I personally haven't been on the customer service lines for some years now. And even when I was, we normally didn't get that that sentiment expressed, because when people got to that point, they just weren't talking to us anymore. Not that they were unhappy with us, but just that they burn out. And the burnout is definitely a factor. And that, if we go back to the conversation a few minutes ago about what kind of people complete the airplanes, well, usually the ones that can really stick with it. And this is not necessarily a put-down for those that do give up. It's just different personalities and different goals in life. And some people are repeat builders. You know, we know a lot of people that have built 3-4 airplanes or more.
Oh, really?
They just and they're never going to give up. But it is a big undertaking, and I respect anybody that gives it a serious effort, even if they don't complete it.
What about flight instruction? I mean, obviously, Rob and I are high-time flight instructors, but we don't teach in experimental aircraft, and so I would imagine you're looking for folks that have got experience in it. How the FAA had a rule a while back that prohibited giving flight instruction for hire in experimentals, and I know that they've made some changes in that area. So tell us about flight instruction. How does one get good instruction in experimental aircraft?
Well, that has improved in recent years, because you're right. From the beginning, you could not use an amateur-built experimental aircraft commercially. This is just one way of distinguishing it from certified airplanes, and it was basically a good rule, because the airplane doesn't necessarily meet the standards of certified airplanes, so it's a reasonable limitation to put on it just to protect the buyer or the customer. As far as instruction, though, the FAA recognized that a lot of the amateur-built airplanes had handling qualities different than typical trainers, so that you really wanted to get transition training in that specific type, and unless somebody is willing to give you that for free, it was difficult to get. So the FAA came up with the LOTA process. I can't even remember exactly what it stands for.
Oh, it's a letter of deviation authority.
Okay, thank you. I really knew that, but I've got brain fade right now. Which basically then permits, under certain conditions, that the airplane can be used commercially for flight instruction for that specific purpose, not for ab initio training, but strictly for transition training. And the aircraft has to have better maintenance standards and various things than apply to a personal use amateur built. That has been a godsend in a way. And even before the LOTA process was commonly used, we had other means of legally doing this. So we've been involved in that, at least supporting that, for over 20 years now in our aircraft. And now there are probably close to a dozen instructors, part-time or otherwise, around the country using their RVs for transition training. And, you know, this is great because, we talked before about trying to make the airplane safe, but you got to make the pilot safe too. And this is a practical way to do it. And the FAA is continuing to work on broadening that policy so that, they can make, you know, the pilot aircraft combination even safer or facilitate doing that. So I applaud the people in the FAA that are pushing for that.
I think that varies in different parts of the world too. Like in Australia, I've never had trouble finding regular normal instructor to give me instruction in my own aircraft.
Well, that's different. That's in your own aircraft, because
you're talking about hiring it.
Sticker comes when you're charging for the use of your airplane for someone else to fly it.
Gotcha. Okay.
Now, in your own airplane, that's always been permissible. And it's quite possible that in Australia or other places, the rules are different. But I can only address what I know here in the U.S. and how the rules or the policies have been changed to permit something that we think is very beneficial.
Well, one observation I can make is that the instructors who have trained me in my own aircraft have all wanted to know whether it's maintained professionally or by a builder. That seems to be the sticking point, but I think that's a personal limitation that the instructors are putting on themselves rather than a regulatory problem.
Well, and I think it's only reasonable for the instructor, and there are probably cases of instructors that may be asked to fly or to give dual this or the other airplane and that would hesitate to do so just because of the unknown qualities of that particular design or sometimes just the structural or the workmanship, et cetera, on that specific airplane. So, yeah, while the rules do permit it, the instructor obviously has no obligation, as he would in any other airplane, to provide that service.
Van, I'm sure we have somebody around the world somewhere right now listening and thinking, wow, this sounds like fun. I think I'd like to look into building my own airplane someday. How would you suggest that people kind of dip their toe in the water and start to explore this possibility?
Well, there's a lot of places they can go on the internet, websites and so on, to learn more. Here in the U.S., the best is to become a member of the Experimental Aircraft Association and take advantage of what they have available. It's kind of a springboard to a lot of opportunity to become member of local chapters and then meet firsthand the people that are doing it. So it's a lot better resource than just looking at something on the computer screen or in a magazine.
Van, one final question. What part of this business really excites you the most? Is it the design, the construction, the customers, the flying? What part of all this really, you know, gets your juices going?
Boy, I don't know if I can pin it down because my involvement has been pretty well across the board of initially building my own prototypes, doing until more recently doing most of the test flying myself. So I've enjoyed all of it. There's been great satisfaction from it. But a lot of the satisfaction is just the feedback we get from the builders, whether it is the enjoyment they get from the building process or then later the flying of the airplane. And that's been extremely rewarding over time to realize that, you know, the people are really getting a benefit from what, well, I've basically made my life's work.
Right. Now, the website, of course, is vansaircraft.com. There must be owner organizations or builders groups or other kind of communities that offer a lot to the prospective builder or those who have built or have bought a built airplane.
Well, within the Vans, what did you call it, sphere, there's another website, vansairforce.net, which is no direct connection to my company. But there, it's, how you'd call it, not more than a chat page, but extremely valuable builder support.
Right, a community.
In other words, yeah. Builders helping builders as opposed to the factory helping builders. So they're both good resources, but the community there is such that, you know, the site has a full-time provider or administrator, and you can spend almost all day following various threads. And like any site, there's opinion, and you kind of got to sort the wheat from the chaff sometime.
Sure.
But definitely very good resources. So at least compared to many, many years ago, there are tremendous resources available to anyone that wants to build. And not only that, but to help him make that person to make the right decision up front, either whether to do it or the choice of designs or projects. So a lot of opportunity there. Definitely, if anyone has even the slightest interest, definitely follow up and learn enough to make a good decision. A lot of people say, well, it has changed my life, I hope, and usually for the better.
All right. Very good. Van, we want to thank you so much for coming on the Airplane Geeks podcast, talking to us and our audience. We really appreciate it.
Well, you're most welcome. I enjoyed it.
The didgeridoo means it's time for the Australia News Desk. Here's two of the craziest guys we could find south of the equator. It's Steve Vischer and Grant McHaren from the Plane Crazy Down Under podcast.
Dateline, 9th of November, 2015, and woohoo, it's a special day, dude.
Oh, that must be. And g'day, folks, and welcome to the Australia Desk for episode 376 on this rather warm Melbourne night. And yes, Grant, happy birthday to you, mate. It's another successful lap around the sun.
Thanks, mate. Yes, I'm now at flight level 480 and climbing successfully. Woohoo. You're the junior burger of the two of us, so whatever.
I'm a sprightly 44, mate.
Ah, junior burger.
Well, I'll tell you what, after yesterday's karate activities, I feel like I'm 144, but we won't go there, Grant. Let's talk about another sport I don't know much about, rugby.
Yes, yes. Despite me saying it's just a glorified Bledisloe Cup, I am still pretty happy that the All Blacks managed to stomp all over the Wallabies. That's right, New Zealand took out Australia in the final of the World Cup rugby.
Oh, I see. So you're choosing to be a New Zealander this week, are we?
When it comes to rugby, I'm usually a New Zealander, yes.
Oh, dear.
Hey, at least we can both turn around and go, hey, Poms.
Well, you lost me at Bledisloe Cup, mate. But anyway, tell us what this has to do with aviation.
Well, the link into aviation is that Qantas and Air New Zealand decided to make a little bit of a wager on the lead up to the World Cup. And Qantas said that if the Aussies won, Air New Zealand were going to have to do something to celebrate the Australian win. And Air New Zealand said that if the All Blacks won, Qantas would have to do the reciprocal. At first, everyone thought there might have been a change in livery on some of the aircraft, and a couple of artist impressions looked pretty good. An Air New Zealand 787 with a yellow body, and then the black fern saying Air New Zealand loves the Qantas Wallabies. That was rather cute. And a Qantas 737-800 in mostly black with a red tail looked really odd, but it did have, you know, Go Richie and All Blacks and Heart, the New Zealand fern, you know, all this kind of stuff, and a whole lot of Kiwi phrases on it. So that was kind of cute, but they went for the slightly cheaper option, and a complete Qantas crew from the tech crew through to the cabin crew all put on all black jumpers and did the entire flight wearing all blacks jumpers just to over the top of their Qantas uniforms. So most amusing, and nice to see the two airlines engaging in a little bit of banter and rivalry.
Yeah, certainly seems to be done in a really good spirit. Did I mention you lost me at Bledisloe Cup?
Yeah, I think you had. So let's move on to something else. Continuing along the themes of stuff that got in the way of having a good time, I note that, there's a different volcano causing problems for Bali.
Yes, it looks like it, Grant. And on the eve, in fact, of some friends of mine conning my wife and I into booking a flight to Bali, it looks like the volcanoes are going nuts over there again. So we're not going until March next year. So I'll tell you what, all you Balinese, you've got several months to get your volcanoes working properly, or just snuff them out, would you? Because nobody's flying there at the moment again.
It looks like the hot spot has moved east, and fortunately didn't trigger anything in Bali as it progressed, but Rinjani over in Lombok to the east of Bali is now spewing out big clouds of ash and causing all sorts of mayhem for the poor people trying to get to and from Bali for their holidays.
Yes, and it looks like, Grant, that a lot of people are going to have to do the option that you took recently, which was to go somewhere else. In fact, Jetstar's offering flights instead to places like Fiji, Thailand, Hawaii, and of course, Virgin is doing pretty much the same. In fact, they're even saying you can go to other places in Australia or around the Pacific, anywhere you like, really, anywhere except Bali. So there are other options, but if you really got your heart set on going to Bali, well, I guess not. Now, Grant, I just noticed, as an aside, we got an email from one of our listeners, Tony Kinsley, who sent us an email just talking about Bali, and he wants to know if he wants to go. He's scared of dengue fever and all this sort of stuff. Well, I tell you what, Tony, don't worry about it, mate, because if these volcanoes keep going the way they are, well, nobody will be flying there.
But, mate, I tell you what, when Qantas, Jetstar and Virgin are rebooking people and they're getting them to pay some money, I'll bet you they're charging those credit card fees.
Yes, well, Grant, hopefully not if the federal government has its way. In fact, it's got all the airlines at the moment in front of a Senate committee asking questions as to, amongst other things, why are you charging all these extra credit card fees all the time? And I'd like to know that myself, Grant. For example, if you're booking a multi-sector flight, why do they charge you, say, in the case of Qantas, I think, about an extra $7 per sector if you're paying all at once.
Yeah, it's really interesting, isn't it? They want you to use their websites. They charge you more to use the phone if you're going to make any adjustments to your bookings or even make new bookings. But when you do use the website, because you're paying via credit card, you go through a credit card processing gateway, which means that if you pay the company $200, the credit card processing gateway remits to you $200 less, say, about 1.5%, which is their fee that they take for providing the service. So it's not uncommon for companies to on-charge that 1.5%, but some of them actually make it 2% or 4%. What's happening is that the airlines are turning around saying, well, look, you know, the cost of processing credit card payments, it's not just the merchant gateway fees, it's all our computer systems and keeping them running and updating them and making sure that everything's ready to go and, you know, support and all that. And I'm like crying, bravo Sierra on this one, blowing snow, mate, because it's like you're going to have those computer systems anyhow and you're going to have the gateway. So what the heck? I could understand them charging enough to cover the gateway fees, but they're trying to claim back enough to cover the whole cost of setting up a computer system, it seems like, and that's just nuts.
Yeah, well, they should just build that into the cost of the fare. Qantas's Group Executive for Government and International Affairs, a gentleman by the name of Andrew Parker, told the hearing today, in fact, that Qantas only gets back about 81% of its what he calls reasonable costs of card acceptance as defined by the Reserve Bank of Australia's guidance note, which all sounds like a lot of political speak to me, Grant.
You got it, man. I mean, if you're going to start going to that level, then let's split everything out. How much does it cost for you to have a CEO? Let's split that out and have that as a fee. You know, CEO support fee. How about, phone call system fee that you never use. But anyhow, it's still there just in case you need it. So you pay a little bit of money.
Yeah.
Let's split it all out. Smiling faces at the check-in. Split it out. Let's itemize everything if you want to go down that path. It's bloody ridiculous.
Well, it must be working for Virgin, Grant, because it looks like they're back in the black. So maybe they'll keep charging these until the cows come home.
Honestly, mate, I think I'm doing my fair share to help keep Virgin in the black. I've been doing a lot of travel lately and there's a bit more coming up on the horizon, all before Christmas. Lots of running around I've got to do with work. But it's great. Virgin have managed to improve their yields, lower their costs, and it looks like they're going to be reporting a profit for the first quarter of 2015 and 2016. They say they're on the track for a full year profit for the whole year, in fact.
Yes, up in the millions. So they're doing very, very well. You know, Grant, I noticed here that they're also saying that their subsidiary, Tiger Airways, and we all know how much I love Tiger Airways, is making a maiden quarterly profit of $400,000. So not much in terms of airlines, I suppose, but at least it's a profit. And as much as I don't like Tiger Air, I wouldn't like to see all the people that work there lose their jobs. So I'm glad it's making money. I'm still not flying them, though.
You're not up for that bus service. Look, I mean, it's $400,000 doesn't sound much for an airline, but compared to the millions they've lost in the past, I think they're doing pretty well. And I'm going to say that I am a contributing factor to this return around because I went to Newcastle in July when we were up doing the Hunter Valley Air Show commentary. Went on the honeymoon to Fiji. Yeah, that was good. I think I'm doing my bit.
Yes, well, Grant, nobody likes a show off. Nobody likes a show off. Well, I'll be flying Virgin to Fiji in a couple of weeks. So there you go. There's my contribution to their profit.
But are you going business class?
No, it's economy class all the way.
Well, you know, I think something that would be even better than economy class would be if you could twist the RAAF's arm and take their latest and final C-17, their eighth one, across to Fiji. How cool would that be?
That's true. And good to see that now we've got eight of these aircraft now. Yes, David, I know that's not many, but you've got to remember, our Air Force is not that big. And it's actually pretty cool that they've had such success with this platform that they've ordered. And I think we originally ordered three, didn't we, Grant? And it's now blown out to eight. So
yeah, 3 to 5 to, let's go for 8. It's been pretty good. And of course, having that many C-17s means that they've had to spend another $300 million just on the new dedicated C-17 maintenance hangar and hard stand and taxi upgrades and so on. So it's put a whole lot of money into the local economy just getting these extra C-17s. The other thing that the RAF have been doing pretty well is sponsoring a couple of female pilot scholarships to help get more ladies into the Air Force.
Yeah, they're certainly doing a big push to get more females in general into the Air Force, and they certainly want more pilots. And this has been co-sponsored, in fact, by the Australian Women Pilots Association.
Yeah, there's a navigation component scholarship worth the $7,000, covers the cost of completing the navigation component for private or commercial. And the second scholarship is for formation or aerobatic endorsement, and it's worth $2,500. So that's pretty damn good.
So ladies, if you're looking at maybe having a shot at that, you can find more about that on their website, which is awpa.org.au. Applications close January 31, 2016. You know, Grant, I wonder if the Australian Seniors Organisation would put in a scholarship for two old, ageing aviation podcasters to go and get those sorts of scholarships and fly for the Air Force. You know, Grant, I still think I could do it. I've flown a Cessna, you know.
Yeah, I know you have. I know you have. And I've flown a balloon just like the Air Force has. So at least my aircraft is on the Air Force register.
Hey! That is awesome. Where do I apply?
Just talk to me, mate. I can organise it for you.
Well, we can dream, I guess. We were dreaming last week. I guess we'll dream a bit more this week. Until next week, I'm Steve Vischer.
And I'm Grant McCarran.
Here, mate, is this your walking frame?
Oh, no, but that may be my bottle of Geritol. Here, swap.
All right, thanks, guys. You can find more of Steve and Grant, of course, at planecrazydownunder.com. Mark, you know, in terms of downloads for airplane geeks, of course, the U.S. has got the largest percentage of the total, followed by the U.K. But after that, it's kind of a tie between Canada and Australia. So I don't know. Maybe we should have a contest, you know, see who can win out for that number three position. What do you think? Think you can pitch us in Australia?
Well, we could play rugby for it.
Oh, yeah.
The winner of the game gets the number two. No, that's not going to work, is it?
Yeah. But it might be fun. So how Australia is obviously a huge country. How deep into the country do you typically fly?
It depends. Just on a weekend, I'll just be like a few hundred miles around the Sydney area. But when I bought the RV6, I had to fly it back from Perth. So that was from one side of the country to the other.
Oh, yeah.
And I've gone as far into the interior as a place called Lake Eyre that you can look up on Google Maps, E-Y-R-E. That's kind of in the centre of South Australia, which is a long way from anything. It's like a 9-hour drive to the nearest city. It's isolated.
So when you flew cross country there, did you go along the coast rather than through the centre?
Well, to get from Perth. Little bit of both. I sort of went from Perth to a place called Kalgoorlie, then a place called Forrest, then followed the coast from Ceduna, and a few other places you can look up on Google Maps. But it's generally fairly easy to navigate around the edges of Australia, because you can just kind of say, well, fly to the coast and then keep Australia on your left and you'll find a town eventually if you're lost.
Yeah, navigation's not too difficult, yeah.
So, Mark, did you go north or did you go south? Did you go up to Darwin or down through Adelaide?
Haven't been as far north as Darwin. When I lived in Adelaide, I went as far north as Lake Eyre.
Yeah, no, I was referring when you went from Perth to Sydney. Did you take a southern route?
It was a few hundred miles inland.
Yeah, okay, but on the southern side.
Yeah, correct.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah. All right, well, let's swing around back to the U.K., and we've got Peter Johnson now across the pond.
Hello there, it's Peter Johnson, and today I'm talking to you from a bit of a noisy and a big echoey science museum. I should be talking to friend of the show, Jamie Dobson, today. But sadly, I messed up the schedule and we weren't able to meet up. But what that made me do is think a little bit about what there is to see in London. Because a lot of people who travel to London from the US and other parts of the world who are listeners to the show do contact me and ask me what is there to see from an aviation perspective in central London. Now, there's two answers to that. The first one, of course, is if you're only limited to central London, there is a bit of a limit to the sorts of things that you're going to be able to see. However, if you are prepared to drive, prepared to make a small train journey, there are lots of aviation fests around London that could really soak up a good week or two of your time. But I'm here in central London. What is there to see in central London? Well, the first thing that sprung to mind is the Science Museum. Now, at the moment, there is an absolutely fantastic Russian cosmonauts exhibition on at the Science Museum. And you do have to pay a little bit to get in to see it, but without doubt, it is probably one of the best aerospace exhibitions on at the moment. And I think that's here until early 2016. So if you are visiting London and you like space and aerospace, please do go and see that. But what I decided to do was pop into the Science Museum. It is free, but when you walk in, it's very clear that they do want you to make a donation, and the suggested donation is £5. Now, what I'm here to do is see what they've got from an aviation and aerospace perspective. So I'm off to the third floor to engineer your future to flight and to the fly zone. Okay, so as you walk into the flight area, what you find is a row of four or five simulators and some film studios to watch things like the Red Arrows and that sort of thing. These are pay exhibitions, so you might want to skip those, or if you've got young kids, they will enjoy those. But when you walk into the flight area, I will give you a very, very quick walk around of what you can see. You're taken on a journey, and that journey is very much about the story of flight. So you come past models and full-scale replicas of early aircraft, and there's everything from the Wright brothers through to supersonic transport. But as you walk along the right-hand side of the exhibition, there is a plethora of fantastic engines and engine cutaways. And one that caught my eye, of course, was the Centaurus. And you can get to see the scale, the size. And what really hits me is things like the weight of these engines that these aircrafts were required to carry, of course, and to power them. But anyway, as we go on towards the back end of the exhibition, we've got probably my favourite jet engine of all time, the wonderfully sounding RB211. And again, you can get really close to this and see the size and scale of these engines. And parked neatly next to it is a Concorde engine, the Olympus, of course, the Rolls-Royce Olympus. As we wrap around towards the back of the exhibition, there is a full size. It is an original Hawker Sydney 125 business jet, and above me is a Harrier, of course, last week's across the pond subject. But there's some wonderful things, like they've got a C-130J Hercules propeller. And you can see the beauty and the craftsmanship of the curves in that thing. And it looks great on the aircraft, but up close you can really see the power and the engineering that's been put into making that propeller really efficient. Now, as you wrap around the other side of the hallway, I think this will be where David Vanderhoof will be very happy. There are some fabulous models, a whole wall full of the whole journey of flight, from the early unpowered gliders right through to the fast jets and the supersonic aircraft. And then in the middle of the hall, we've got a Supermarine Spitfire. We've got a Tiger Moth. We've got a Messerschmitt Comet hanging from the ceiling, amongst other aircraft. So there are about, 10 or 15 aircraft hanging from the ceiling. And it's a great display. Now, you could walk around this in 10 or 15 minutes, or if you're like me and have got a few hours to kill, you could probably do 1 or 2 hours in this hall. It's a great hall. I love it. I remember it as a child, and although it's changed a fair bit since the early days, it's a great exhibition. And do you know what? It's not very busy. So I'm just going to go downstairs and we're going to go and have a look at one of my other favourite areas, and that's the space area. So I've come down the back stairs, and the first thing you see is the Apollo 10 capsule. And that is the real capsule that went all the way to the moon and back. On the other side of the hall is a V1, and there are aircraft hanging from the ceiling too. And as you walk through, you go past the oldest steam locomotive ever, the Puffin Billy, as you walk towards the space exhibits. And there is a full-scale lunar lander, and you can see how large that was. I was genuinely surprised. I've seen it before, but every time I see it, I'm surprised at how large it is. And in the space hall, you also have some fantastic satellites, rocket engines, of course, with the mighty Saturn V, and there's an example of a small part of a Saturn V engine as well. Hanging from the ceiling, though, is a Black Arrow, and that is quite an impressive piece of equipment as well. You can walk back into the main hall. There's a cafe there, and I hope you've enjoyed that very, very quick run around some of the aerospace exhibits in the Science Museum. Now, there's loads and loads and loads more, and I haven't done justice to it, but I thought I'd just give you a little insight to what there is right in the middle of London for you to see. Now, one other must not miss when you're in London, it is only a tube ride away if you're staying in central London, is the RAF Museum at Hendon. But if you're visiting London, or if in fact you're visiting the UK, do drop me a line and I will try and help you find the best things that you will want to see whilst you're over here. So, this is Peter Johnson, reporting for the Airplane Geeks from across the pond.
Oh, thanks, Peter. Boy, Peter makes a great tour guide. Boy, I'm psyched. I'm ready to go. Mark, have you got any great aviation museums in Australia? I'll put you on the spot.
Yeah, we do. In fact, next weekend, the weekend of, I think it is the 21st, there's a Warbirds Day at the Tamora Museum, which is in central New South Wales. And they have Australia's only two airworthy Spitfires, the Historical Aircraft Restoration Society from Wollongong is flying some of their World War II vintage aircraft out there so that people can have a look at those. So, it should be a fairly big weekend. I think it's on Friday and Saturday next weekend.
All right. Yeah, sounds great. Sounds very good. All right, let's go on to some listener mail. As always, we receive so much listener mail. It's kind of impossible for us to answer all of them. It's definitely difficult to get all of them on the show, but we try to do our best. First, we'll start off with one from Jeffrey. We had talked about the J-Lens balloon or aerostat that broke away from its moorings in Maryland and floated across Pennsylvania before coming down. We talked about that last time, I think. Wasn't it Max West?
Yes, it was.
Jeffrey says this wasn't the first time something like this has happened.
No, I mean, we heard from our listener that this actually happened back in 1942. Do you remember that?
Rob might.
No, I don't think so. Rob, do you remember this one?
I'm sorry, what? were you talking to me? Oh, no, I don't remember that.
Well, apparently this was back during World War II in Seattle, where a U.S. Army barrage balloon dragged across a number of power transmission lines north of Seattle, cutting all the electric power to the city. And unfortunately, we just entered the war, and so a lot of folks were concerned that this outage meant that there were enemy aircraft approaching. So apparently it really scared the daylights out of people. So it's not unprecedented for these balloons to get loose.
And drag their cables across power lines, causing all kinds of difficulties. All right.
Cutting off power to a city is one of the scary stories that's used to get people upset about the idea of cyber terrorism.
Sure.
Can you imagine if someone other than the U.S. military had done this, how much noise and panic there would be?
Oh,
and they've done it twice.
Yeah, it would just be disaster, just mayhem, I'm sure. We're going to put a photograph of a clock in the show notes. And this is something that was sent to us asking for some more information about it. And it's a clock. It says United Airlines Transport Corporation on the face of the clock. So this is something that goes back to probably to the 30s or 40s, I'm guessing. But it has some very interesting markings on it. Now, we've passed this along to sort of our network to try to help identify this. But as we say, we'll put a picture of this in the show notes. And if you have any information about the history or just exactly what this is or what the markings mean, please let us know. Write to us at thegeeks@airplanegeeks.com.
Hey, can we send all the winners a button?
Sure.
And this apparently it says United Air Lines, two separate words, Transport Corporation. And I understand that that particular company name went away in 1934. So this is a very, very early clock.
Yeah. But the other thing that strikes me is I thought that the original company was United Aircraft Transport Corporation. And this is United Air Lines Transport Corporation. So that's kind of confusing to me. But yeah, that was the whatever it was, that was the company that was broken up subsequently, as you say, Max T, into United Airlines and Boeing and United Aircraft, which became United Technologies, which is Pratt & Whitney and, you know, some other companies as well. So, yeah, there's some interesting history, interesting corporate history to that as well.
Well, if I can just interject with one thought, I brought this photo to our flying club breakfast on Saturday morning last. And we have a number of really smart people in our flying club. And I passed it around and I said, does anybody know what this thing is? And there's one real smart smart person who happens to be a 777 captain for an airline I don't particularly care for. But we won't go down that road. But he knew what it was immediately.
Really?
Yeah, absolutely. He looked at it and he said, it's obviously a clockometer.
A clockometer?
Yeah.
What's a clockometer?
Well, that's what I said. And then he went, you know, for an old guy, you are such a sucker.
I really can't believe he doesn't know what a clockometer is. He's probably not.
Yeah.
I mean,
Yeah,
right, of course.
Keep that man a button.
Hey, say it with confidence and people will believe you.
That's right.
That's right. That's exactly what he did.
Yeah.
So. Glenn sent us a photo continuing on the favorite airline paint jobs theme that we've been talking about for a couple of weeks here. And this, we'll put again in the show notes. This is, I've seen this before. It says Flying 101 plane, where it has everything labeled on the exterior. You know, captain, a co-captain is an arrow, nose cone pointing to the front, and so forth. So, it's kind of an amusing paint job. Thanks to Glenn for sending that in. Also, Fred sent in a really great video. I just really like this video. It's called Beneficia safety video with Emirates. I don't even know where that is.
I thought that was marvelous myself.
Yeah, tell us about that video, Rob. What did you think about it?
Well, what it was is that it was a soccer game in, my goodness, I don't know if I know what city that was.
It was in Portugal, I remember, and it was a fantastic video. Unbelievable. Go ahead.
And rather than simply announce the game, they had, eight or ten Emirates flight attendants come out on the field and kind of work the crowd to get them pumped up for the game. But they used aviation safety video kind of terminology, but they substituted phrases and words from the game in place. And it was just – it was obviously to show the Emirates brand, but it was also to get people pumped up about the game. And I just – thought it was so well done. If you do nothing else after you listen to this show, before you destroy it, that is, make sure you go watch that video because it really was well done.
Yeah, it is.
It was amazing. There's so many videos out there. This one just stood head and shoulders above most of the ones that you're going to see. It was very creative, and Emirates deserves all the, you know, all the free publicity they can get from doing it.
I agree.
It was that good.
The flight attendants are phenomenally beautiful as well.
It's less than 2 minutes, so it's an easy watch. Just so visit airplanegeeks.com/376, and you'll be able to see it there.
Oh, what a shallow thought, Brian, that you simply looked at how pretty the flight attendants were. I really like the brunette. I thought she was really
pretty. All right.
Jeez. Moving right along.
Craig wrote in and said he was listening to our episode 374 with Ms. Benzing was our guest. While returning from an animal rescue flight. He goes on with the letter, but I asked him about it, and he said that this was actually his first animal rescue flight, and this was with pilots and paws. that he says he's heard of it. He had heard of it on a podcast. He just can't remember if it was ours or someone else's, but it doesn't matter. He found Pilots and Paws. He was flying to San Francisco anyway, and so he says, so it was easy to take a few kittens along. And I just,
it's like angel flight for puppies.
Exactly. Yeah. And just, oh, that's so cute. But anyway, that's not why Craig wrote. Craig wrote that as he was listening, he said, I had a thought I could help you with. This is on the angle of attack indicators, AOA. I was asking some stupid questions about how you calibrate them. And he says that on at least on a Garmin product, the AOA indicator is indeed calibrated in flight. He sent some photos from that, put them in the show notes. The procedure includes a number of predetermined angles of attack all the way to full stall. He said, no, a regular pilot wouldn't do the AOA calibration. An avionics installer or aircraft mechanic would ideally set the parameters while the pilot flies the plane to a stall. He says, regular PTS, nothing fancy or dangerous. What's PTS?
Practical test standard. So if you're doing a check ride, you use the PTS as guidance for the examiners to what they perform. So I think his point is that this is pretty, you know, vanilla type stall. It's just your average everyday stall, nothing fancy.
Okay, good.
In fact, if you did a fancy sudden stall, you'd probably be off calibration because that's not the kind of thing that you would do on final approach when you really want an angle of attack indicator.
All right, Neil. Finally, Neil wrote to us. He said, I've been listening for a long time. As David and Max would know, I love my UAVs. He says, I have always thought I don't really have much to contribute to your show as I am not a pilot, but just a really keen aerospace enthusiast. So let me stop there.
Hey,
so Neil,
I was going to say, that doesn't stop me.
That's
I contribute
right.
all the time. So yeah. Keep it coming.
Don't let that stop anybody, that's for sure.
No, and didn't we figure something like close to half our listeners aren't pilots? I mean, they're as much a part of the audience as people who are pilots. So,
right.
No, that I mean, they should contribute just as well.
Yeah, and even stupid questions. Or not that Neil's going to ask a stupid question. But
I want to put something out to the people who are pilots, which is fly with other people. There's so much grizzling about how GA is getting smaller and smaller as years go by.
Yeah.
If you can convince one other person to become a pilot, then that arrests that decline. If you can convince two other people to become a pilot, then numbers will double overnight.
Perfect.
And become a flight instructor, and you can even quadruple those numbers.
Yes, very quickly and easily, yes.
All right. So back to Neil. Neil says, as a kid, I used to watch air shows from my family home on our roof with my dad. We lived near Royal Australian Air Force's base Edinburgh. Australia. Edinburgh.
That's my old stomping ground.
I knew I knew there was a reason to bring you on. In South Australia, sorry. A few years ago, I traveled to Safran, and to my luck, it was Navy Week. I saw for the first and maybe the last time in my life a B-2 bomber. He says to see it fly in real life was just stunning. So he sent us a few of the images that he took from the day. We've got some pictures from the B-52 and some other aircraft, and they're really, really good photographs. We'll put those in the show notes. Thanks, Neil, for passing those along.
Hey, and speaking of the B-2, we were talking last week about the Grumman win of the long-range strike bomber, and I think you had said to David that you're going to rely on him at some point to kind of guess what shape that's going to look like. I had a conversation over the weekend with Alan Brown, who's the designer of the F-117 stealth fighter, and he commented that it would almost certainly have to look something like the B-2 just because how optimal that that design shape was. And somebody commented, oh, so kind of like well, they'll call it the B-3, and Alan said instantly, no, it's more like a B-2.5.
Yeah, a lot of the artist renderings that are, I don't know, I think based on nothing other than the artist's imagination that I see out there for this new bomber do look a lot like the B-2. So. But yeah, it is something to watch. I saw it many years ago at the Singapore Air Show when it did a flyby. And I knew it, I think I've told a story, but I knew it was coming. I knew which direction it was going to come from, so I was watching for it. And I tell you, that thing was so quiet that almost, I would say 90% of the crowd never even knew it was overhead until it was like directly overhead. They, you know, they missed the first half of the flyby because the thing just, it just glided through the air silently. It was,
yep. That sounds, you know, terrible. Who wants a quiet airplane at an air show?
There's a trick to that though, Max.
Yeah.
Because in fact, it's funny. I don't think I would have even thought of this, but I just interviewed a couple of the guys that flew the Dassault's 7X at the Reno Air Races. I guess that was a month or so ago.
Yeah.
And they were talking about how fast they go when they get close to the crowd. And I said, wow, that must just be, you know, really incredible how fast you're moving. And he said, actually, we get to 300 knots and then we throttle back. He said, you throttle back? He said, yeah, because if we do that, we're going so fast, it's tough enough for people to see what it is anyway. But then we sound really quiet when we go by. People think we're at full power, but we're not.
Ah.
So now we've uncovered a flyby trick.
The secret's out. All right.
Yes.
Thank you for
that. I don't know. What's really interesting, every once in a while, they'll show up for the Rose Parade. And living in Pasadena, I'm in line of sight of the flyby for the Rose Parade.
You're talking about the B-2.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's so incredible when it comes by because it is well past you by the time you hear it, even when it's at, I don't know, 500, 750 feet when it does the flyby. It's really low, and it's so incredibly quiet.
Cool. All right. Well, I think that's going to do it for this episode of the Airplane Geeks podcast. We want to thank our guest again was Dick Van Groesven, the founder and CEO of Vans Aircraft. We also want to thank you, Mark Newton, just one of our listeners who we're glad to be able to get on the show and have a little conversation with you. Thanks for doing that, Mark.
And thanks for hanging around for this extended version of the Oz Desk. Thanks very much.
Yeah.
Hey, and Mark, how long did you say you've been a listener?
I don't even know. 6 or 7 years, I think.
Wow. So you really don't have much of a social life then, huh?
I used to listen to you a lot while riding a bike.
Hey, thanks for doing it.
All right. Also, our co-hosts here, let's tell them where they can find each of you. Brian, we'll start with you.
Oh, I'm still not being social, so the best place to get a hold of me is brian@airplanegeeks.com.
And Max Trescott?
Oh, just go to jetwine.com, send a note to Rob, and have him contact me. No, you can. The usual.
That's good. That's good.
I should use that one. Darn it.
Oh, the usual places, maxtrescott.com or Max Trescott on Facebook or g1000book.com.
All right, Rob, the mystery is out, but again, where can folks find you?
Well, if they type in Jetwine, they'll probably find me somewhere. But it probably links to one of these other crazy places like this. And in case you can't find me, just call and leave a message, and someone will get back to you.
All right. And I'm Max Flight. You can find me on Twitter as Max Flight, also on LinkedIn, the UAVDigest.com every Friday with David Vanderhoof in the PaxX podcast with Mary Kirby. You can find us at airplanegeeks.com. Show notes for this episode at airplanegeeks.com/376. We're also on all the usual social media places. Look for us on Twitter, Facebook, Google+. You can also listen to us on Stitcher.com or TuneIn Radio. The email address is thegeeks@airplanegeeks.com. Opening and closing music is by Brother Love. Find him at brotherloverocks.com. So please join us again next week as we talk aviation on the Airplane Geeks podcast. Bye, everybody.
Fly safely.
Good night, everybody.
Keep the blue side up.
Bye-bye from Sydney.
2017, their eighth one, across to Fiji. How cool would that be?
You mean our wonderful friends at the Royal Australian Air Force Media Unit? You know, Grant, I always said they were great guys over there.
Oh, they're the best. And, you know, Eamon Hamilton is in charge of public affairs for Air Mobility Group. I'm sure if anyone can wangle it, it's going to be him.
Oh, Hamilton, the man with the best moustache in the Air Force, I say.
He's certainly working it with a great story this Movember, I tell you. He's doing great.
That's true. But that's actually the point of this story, Grant, is actually about the eighth and final C-7.
Yes,
it was.
Jeffrey says this wasn't the first time something like this has happened. That's your cue.
I know. I'm so sorry. I don't have this story board up.
Okay.
Go ahead. Let me bring it back up here.
That's okay.
Sorry, usually I'm more with it than this, but...
That's okay. Want me to go?
MXT is tap dancing.
Yeah. No. I'm sure hoping this is getting cut out.
Oh, no, it's making the bloopers.
Yeah. Oh, boy. Well, you want to start again?
So this wasn't the first... And this wasn't the first time that we've seen something like this happen, was it?
No, I mean, we heard from our listener that this actually happened back in 1942. Do you remember that?
All right. Aren't you supposed to be at work, Mark?
I just booked a long meeting.
Yeah, like a two-hour middle-of-the-day meeting.
We have fairly flexible work hours here, so it's okay.
Okay, so you're not in trouble?
Oh, no.
Okay.
Not yet.
Good.